what it really breaks down to is people are motivated by one of three things. One, it's to feel competent. Two is to feel connected. And three is to feel autonomous. What I was really trying to lean into with this whole report is that connectedness.
I'm Jonathan Gandolf, and welcome to the Content Cocktail Hour, powered by The Juice. Our mission is to squeeze out the deepest secrets of B2B marketing professionals to help you push your brand to the forefront of the industry. Let's raise the glass. Welcome back to the Content Cocktail Hour. Jonathan here, founder and CEO of The Juice and the host of today's episode. I am thrilled to be joined by one of my favorite content marketers, if not the favorite, Tommy Walker here. We first met, ironically, at a cocktail hour, I think, in Boston, in the basement of a bar. I'm blanking on the bar, but hit it off right away. We've gotten to formally, informally partner together since then. And he just launched a report, The State of Discontent, that is awesome. Strongly encourage everybody to go check it out. We're going to go through the entire kind of process of that report, some of the key findings and everything else today. So this is going to be a fun conversation. I think a very tactical as well as kind of strategic advice as well for content marketers out there. So I'm going to stop rambling because I could probably ramble this entire episode. Tommy, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself in your own words and what you're up to now?
So I am Tommy Walker. I am the founder of The Content Studio. It is a consultancy for high growth startups and Fortune 1000 companies. In the last few years, we've consulted with companies like LinkedIn, Vimeo, GoDaddy was one of our first clients, and other companies of that caliber. Twitch was another one. And that's primarily what we focus on is content marketing consulting that are unable to be created anywhere else and that your competitors want to copy.
That is a great positioning message there. I'm excited to dig into it all. Before we do that, this is the Content Cocktail Hour. Tommy, what are you enjoying drinking nowadays?
Water.
It's a good answer. It's a healthy answer.
If you had asked me this just not that long ago, I probably would have said I'm a big New York whiskey sour guy. That's usually what I drink when I'm out. But yeah, now it's just water, as much water as I possibly can.
I could learn a little bit from that as somebody who's had too much coffee already this morning. Before we actually dig in, I mentioned this at the top, but the State of Discontent report, very creative there. In the age of state of reports, I think this one stands out. First, do you just want to give an overview of what the report is? And then we're going to dig into the process that kind of led you to wanting to do it and the creation process as a whole.
Yeah, so the report is the State of Discontent Report. Definitely a nice little play on words there. And what it was a quantification of some of the discontent that was happening in the content marketing space that's been going on for the last few years. I've been in this space for just about 20 years at this point. In these last couple of years in particular, there's been a completely different vibe than what I've ever noticed. And said, let's quantify this because I wanted to tap into something that was a little bit more primal that was happening with an industry that I love very much. And I really wanted to see what people's challenges were in the space. So we had 545 respondents. We had anywhere between 20 to 25 questions, depending on which segment you were in. And there was an average of 21 minute completion time and a 41.7% completion rate, which means that people really took their time with the survey and let it sit. And it was great. We had really great findings that came after it.
You mentioned you felt this vibe in market that was maybe more negative than it had been previously. What was the moment? What was the tipping point for it going from, hey, this is something I'm feeling to this is something that I need to tangibly quantify to help others?
When my cohort at the beginning of the year did not sell out the way that I wanted it to. At the beginning of the year, I teach this course called Content Theory, and we had done the first cohort at the beginning of the year, and it was a great cohort. People in there are saying, like, justice for cohort one, because it was really, like, it was very powerful. But I didn't fill as many seats as I would have liked to have. And when I was doing the retrospect of, like, hey, how come this didn't actually work the way I wanted it to? The big part was, hey, you didn't actually run through any of your own process to get this out there, to get the content out there, to get the right people or whatever. So what I did was I started to go through my own creative development process. I secured my distribution first. I looked for ideas that were happening out there, kept my ear to the ground, used my own monitoring sort of market research, you know, systems, put that all in place, and then arrived at, hey, this would be something that I think would go over really well. Before I ever wrote a line, before I did anything, I reached out to you. I reached out to Jimmy over at Superpath. I worked with Rob over at Audience Led. and a few other partners over at Spark Toro. I worked with them. And I said, hey, is this something that you think would be interesting to your audience? You probably remember that conversation. Mm-hmm. And when the idea and the concept was the thing that got, you know, yeah, that sounded really good. Then it was like, okay, now can we develop questions together? What kinds of questions do we want to get? I wanted to secure the distribution first and then go in and create the thing. Because, you know, it was an investment. But by doing that, it allowed me to, one, validate my own methodologies. But then two, by the way that the questions were designed, how they were presented, the way that the whole survey flow was, all the little micro decisions that go into that type of content, all of that paid off. It got the responses that I hoped that it would get. It got the volume of responses that I hoped it would get. Do you remember me saying, I want people to have kind of an existential crisis by the time they're done with the survey, right? That was one of the things, is like, I knew going into it, if I phrased the questions in a certain way and I placed them in a certain order and I got the information in different ways, that we would kick off a narrative in people's heads. And what ended up happening was some of the qualitative feedback we got after the survey, just when the survey was out, was like, this was the first time I felt like a survey ever really cared what I had to say. A lot of people were telling me, DMing me like, hey, this was really cathartic. Thank you for giving me a spot to vent. And then after the reports come out, the biggest response was, oh my God, I'm not alone, which is like all stuff that was very much by design, but also like, because I kind of knew what I was tapping into through the validation and everything else.
Yeah, I do remember that first meeting. I remember almost having like a weight lifted off my shoulders of like, oh, I'm not the only person feeling this. Like, I'm not alone. And then like your ability to kind of harness that from the rest of the ecosystem. That's why we are like, yes, like say less, we're in from the very get-go. So kudos to you. And I think there's such a good lesson in there. And I'm a little bit biased given what The Juice does is content distribution, but so smart to think distribution first and then reverse engineer from that. That's why we created The Juice, because we as marketers, myself included, get so caught on this content creation hamster wheel. We just create without the distribution plan. If we could just flip a little bit of that energy to distribution first, you see the results like you did with this report. So kudos to you.
Yeah, that was one of the most important things, is it's like when I worked in-house, this was one of the biggest things. You know, we saw this in the report, but it's also something that I experienced in-house. A lot of people will come up with these big swing ideas and then go out and create the whole thing and then put it out to market and go, will you take this? And it's like, you're not hedging your bets against failure in that case. So what I wanted to do, since I'm investing some of my own time and money into this, was like, how do I hedge my bets against failure and also make sure that I'm going to tap into the get the ground zero of the audiences that I want to be going after. And again, 545 responses for the first time I've ever run a survey like this is massive.
Yeah, you raise the floor from the get-go, right? Like the ceiling gets that much higher as well. So really, really smart there. Let's talk about the survey. I think it's easy to talk about a state of report and talk about the results and the content itself. But I don't think many people, unless you've been through this process, understand how big of an endeavor just creating the survey is, especially there's multiple stakeholders involved. You had some pretty sophisticated kind of branching within the survey. I think you mentioned this a little bit earlier as well. Like, you want to lead them to the water, you want them to drink a little bit, but you also want it to be open enough that you get new perspective and valid perspective that way as well. So just tell us about the project that is the survey in and of itself.
So there are two levels to the way I wanted to think about the survey, right? Now, a lot of surveys that I've experienced are you get asked the question and then you see the answer to the question on the other side of that. And there's definitely an element of that. But going into this survey, I already knew that I wanted to cross-analyze certain bits of information with each other. And the survey was broken up into three different areas, basically, which was career satisfaction, trouble with AI, and audience research. Right. And what I was really looking for on the back end of that was going, okay, now how can I find the correlations between our audience research questions and our career satisfaction or our compensation satisfaction or creative satisfaction? Right. Can we start to draw these parallels or leadership buy-in? Right. Can we start to find these parallels if we ask these questions, which are perfectly fine questions on their own, standalone, but can we get that data that tells a much more comprehensive story than just, if I ask you this question, you know, a call and response to that. So that was like the first thing going into it. The big goal of the data and the types of questions that I was asking was to get that sort of cross analysis, which I don't see a lot of surveys actually pulling that type of stuff out. It's like, okay, how many blog posts do you publish per year? Right? Like that's what a lot of the surveys I see out there for state of surveys say. But then the other part of that was going, okay, now how can we pace these questions out? I think about things very narratively. My whole background before I ever got into this was like acting. I was a storyteller for many, many years before I ever got into marketing. So the whole thing was, how can I pace this in a way and phrase these questions in a way that's going to make it easy for somebody to like get to a point where now I've got you, right? So first handful of questions were your basic demographic questions. How long have you been doing this for? Where are you? What's the size of your company? What industry are you in, et cetera? But then I think it was the eighth question where it was like, are you creatively fulfilled? Yes, no. By the time you get to that point, now I'm asking you a very confronting question up front, and we're starting to kick off that narrative in your head. So we're starting to ease those questions or get those questions out there and phrased in a way that makes it so like I'm willing to open up. And what we saw, I mean, we had, I think it was like 450,000 something words worth of qualitative feedback, and people were going off. Like people were contacting me afterwards saying like it felt really cathartic, and it's because we phrased it. I tried to pace the questions and phrase them in a way where it allowed a level of vulnerability that I don't think a lot of surveys will get. And like I said, somebody said this was the first time I felt like a survey really cared what I had to say. That was all very much by design.
I love the sneaky power of the confronting question being yes or no. It's not 1 to 5. It's not a little bit, a lot of it, some of it. It is yes, no. There's no hiding from that. I think that in and of itself, the thoughtfulness that goes into kind of forcing that decision to be that stake to be stuck in the ground, yes or no, no in between, is part of what made it effective.
Another really interesting one there too is like audience research, right? Like one of the questions that we asked near the end of the survey was be honest, right? And this is how it was phrased, be honest, how often are you doing your audience research? And it was daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, yearly, and then not nearly enough. Now, like not nearly enough, that little phrase versus never, it's code for never, but like it's sort of an admission without being like, because nobody's going to say, like no marketer is going to say, I don't do my audience research. Like, no, like I would never say that even if I, but if we say not nearly enough and it was phrased just that way and we had all the other options, like that was a way to get people to be comfortable answering a question that confronting, that honestly. And by the way, like 41.3% of people took the survey said they weren't doing their audience research nearly enough. And just to tease the survey a little bit for anybody listening, that has negative correlations across every other vector of the survey. So,
yeah, we'll get there. We'll get there. We're not there yet.
We'll get there. All right.
Yeah. And kudos to you on the attention to detail to frame those questions properly. So you get the answers to the questions. I think the next step in the process is you get 543 responses. And then what the hell do I do with all this data, right? You hope it validates your hypothesis, maybe. And you have to admit where maybe it doesn't. But like, what now, once you get all the responses?
You stare at a spreadsheet with a sense of existential crisis and go, what the hell did I just do? Fortunately, I have a data scientist that I used to work with when I was at QuickBooks. And I said, hey, help me make heads and tails of this. Like, I want to be able to cross-reference these bits and vectors of data and really think about these things in this way. And I was very fortunate that he was able to do a lot of that stuff. But then also, I'll be honest, like there was a lot of ChatGPT involved, but it was not just me saying, hey, ChatGPT, tell me these things. It was like knowing the questions to ask the data once you have the data is a whole, like that was a whole different set of things, right? And then validating what it was that I was seeing, like, okay, does that make sense? There was a lot of manual filtering and pivot tables and all sorts of crap that was just a matter of like looking at it and going, okay, now what correlations exist between these things? Like if I look at audience research versus leadership buy-in, can I start to find those parallels? And then be very clear when I do the final reporting that this is correlation, not causation, because you end up with chicken and egg scenarios. But like being very clear about the questions that you're trying to ask of the data once you have it, because it wasn't just a matter of, like I said, I didn't want just call and response. I wanted to see what the cross analysis was. So figuring out those questions and coming up with more questions of that data as you're going along. Like, that was the biggest surprise for me, is going like, okay, I'm not just taking all of this stuff at face value. Like, now I have this question. Now I see this. Like, what else is really interesting? And then taking long breaks, because it was very sad reading some of the stuff, as much as some of it was very disappointing or very depressing. I think that answers the question.
Yeah, that's awesome. One more like tactical question that I swear we're going to get to results. And longtime listeners, this might be a slightly longer episode, but I'm just fascinated by it all. So the format of delivery here, you send me a draft of the report and like the first version of the report. And you're like, here you are. It's 200 plus pages. And I was like, what? It's 200 plus pages. But then like, I remember I clicked through the report, and at the end of the report, I was like, oh, that's all. Like, I want more. Let's talk about like format. So you've got all this really rich data. How do you make decisions on what's too much to deliver? What stays on the cutting room floor? How does my audience actually want to consume the findings now?
There's a ton of deleted scenes, right? There's a lot of stuff that still didn't make it. And I still feel like I crammed it full of extra stuff. But it actually goes into the stuff that I teach in my program, which is the way that it's structured is actually through layers of conflicts. So there's a famous script writing instructor. His name is Robert McKee. And one of the things that he's brought to the table that is really excellent are there are three layers of conflict in any story, right? One is extra personal conflict. So things like forces of nature, weather, things that are completely out of our control. The second one is personal conflict. So relationships with people, bosses, coworkers, lovers, friends, etc. And then interpersonal conflict. So relationships with your mind, your body, or your emotions. And the way that the report was structured overall was economics, what was happening in the broad state of affairs, right? The middle section is relationship with management, leadership buy-in. And then the final section is creative fulfillment and personal satisfaction. So the way that the report was structured was very much done on intentionally, because I knew that as we were going through each section, we're going to be telling a macro down to the micro story. And that's going to be part of the thing that keeps people engaged for 220 pages.
Yeah. Again, the thoughtfulness that went into that ahead of time. And it's fascinating. I mean, maybe it sounds obvious when you say it out loud, but it's parallel to how you structured the survey, right? So it's like, again, that thoughtfulness ahead of, you've reverse engineered everything, going back to doing distribution first, what you want the delivery to be, filters into the survey format, filters into the survey questions, filters into who you work with to build the survey. I think that's my big takeaway from this entire process.
You want to hear something else? Because yes. Like the survey and my course are like they're inextricably linked at this point. Yeah. So the other part is there's a theory of motivation, right? There's something called the self-determination theory, which is why are we motivated to do anything? What it breaks down to, it's a 40-year body of research, but what it really breaks down to is people are motivated by one of three things. One, it's to feel competent. Two is to feel connected. And three is to feel autonomous. What I was really trying to lean into with this whole report, and again, I knew this going into the whole thing, is that connectedness part, right? Can I create a piece of content that people feel like it connects them to each other and creates that feeling of, oh, I'm not alone in this. And because of that, there's been a ton of downstream sharing that's happened as a result. It's very easy to have these conversations to go, hey, I want to do a podcast, or let me get a public speaking engagement, or any of these other things, because it is by design that it's tapping into one of the very three basic needs, or one of the three very basic motivation triggers that we have.
So good. Mission accomplished. Because like I said, even when you were asking for the distribution, like kind of partners, I was like, I don't know what this is going to be, but I'm in. Because I feel this, right? Like, and I feel like I want to be a part of it with the community. Yep. And I've felt that since the launch of the report as well. So let's talk about the report at last. You've broken a few of your other maybe concepts into the three ways. I'm curious, maybe give us your three biggest takeaways without all of the spoilers from the report, because we will obviously link to it in the show notes here. And obviously, we encourage everyone to go read it. But for you, what were the three biggest takeaways from what was presented in the report?
Really, it's all one, right? It all comes down to one. It's audience research is the crux of everything. And if the majority of people are saying they're not doing their audience research nearly enough, then what we're saying out there publicly is very different than what we're actually saying when it comes to actually doing the work. I know that almost every other marketing blog post that I read starts with do your audience research. But then what I've noticed is that when this was especially validated through the report, that has so many different definitions, first and foremost. But the other part of that is there's not like a standardized framework, which again is something I teach in the content theory course. It's such an amorphous term that even if I am doing my audience research, what does that mean? One, and then two, how do I even apply that? right? Most people who got into content marketing did not say, I want to be a content marketer when I grow up. I was an actor. I know plenty of people who were journalists or poets or English majors. So even knowing what to do for audience research is one thing. And then two, how to apply that to actual, like, the creation of the content itself, that's a whole nother. But the problem is that the lack of audience research has negative effects across leadership buy-in, across creative satisfaction, compensation satisfaction, like every other vector of the survey. Confidence in voice and tone. Like, when you put it this way, it makes complete sense that people are less confident in their voice and tone the less research that they do, right?
Well, you phrasing that question of not nearly enough. You know, somebody could say they're doing it quarterly and be satisfied with that. Another person could be doing it quarterly and still think that's not nearly enough, right?
Right.
And I think that's kind of the mystery of it all. But I feel that ourselves. Part of the reason we have a podcast, and I tell our team all the time, like, we get good downloads, we get good listens, we distribute it through our platform. We're fortunate to have that tool in our tool belt. But if nobody listened to it, I would still do it because it's a right. forcing function to do the audience research, to go talk to customers, talk to prospects, talk to people in the market. So I think there are ways that we all can force that into what we're already doing. So I'm curious to maybe wrap the conversation before I ask our last question we ask all of our guests, but maybe the last question on this report is, like, what have you learned from the report? How will this change what Tommy and the Content Studio do moving forward?
That's a very good question. I think the big thing for me is, how can I continue to extract insights or extract the information that I'm seeing and then turn that into actual practical, like, interpret that and then go, how can I help the market, like, with these things? So, like, the lack of audience research, one of the things that I found is, again, it comes back to, what does that even mean? So I have this whole 8-layer market research process that I go through that, like, can I bridge that gap and really help do that? But then the next thing is, like, okay, now that we've done the survey and I'm going to do it again year after year, how can we start to tailor questions a little bit differently towards different groups? Can we bring in more people and have a better sample size of the different sides and work with the audience a little bit more, not just my distribution partners, but now that there is an audience, work with that audience a little bit more and find out, hey, what else do you want to know that other people in, like, the agency space or the freelance writer space, right? What do you want to know about what's going on with them? Can we incorporate that into the findings?
I love that. You're speaking for all of us. I think that's so powerful to kind of feel the energy in the ecosystem.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, let's quantify what we're all feeling. So kudos to you on that.
Thank you.
The last question we do ask all of our guests is, what is one unpopular opinion that you have as it pertains to marketing?
Everybody says the playbook is dead. I don't think the playbook is dead. I think that TV has been running the same playbook for years. They're going to continue running some iteration of the same playbook over and over again. It's not a playbook problem. It's an execution problem. And if I can get people to take a survey for 21 minutes and read 220 pages and keep themselves asking, is that it? Where's more? Like, it's an execution problem. It's not a playbook problem.
Oh, I love that. On the day of this recording, actually, in my newsletter that I write on Fridays, I just titled it Brute Force. I was like, everyone says everything is dead. I don't know. Just do the hard work. Like,
yeah,
and it'll work. I think sometimes people use the playbook as a crutch to not do the hard work. So I love that perspective. It's popular between the two of us. Tommy, if people want to learn more from you or check out the report or follow you, what's the best way to do that?
thecontentstudio.com/the-state-of-discontent-report, I think. Or you can find me on LinkedIn. That's where I spend most of my time now. So linkedin.com/in/Tommy is my name. And then I have my course. It's a cohort-based program that we teach. We're actually going into the last one starting next week. So by the time this publishes, it'll probably be already done. The course is called Content Theory. It is a 5-day program where I deconstruct market research, show you how to go through an 8-layer market research process to then turn that into really compelling creative development, and then start to use psychology and ancient philosophy and acting principles and screenwriting principles to really dig into creating content that gets people engaged and completely distinct and differentiated from everything that's out there in the market.
You mean to tell me I don't need to just go prompt ChatGPT for 1,200 words on a random blog post?
I can actually show you how to prompt ChatGPT on 1,200 words and get something that's better than 98% of what human writers are going to put out there for you.
Well, there you go. Everybody, go check out Tommy. I've learned a lot from him. This report is incredible. I trust you'll learn a lot. I think we'll all be participating in it again next year. And excited to see, Tommy, what else you can kind of bring from the ecosystem to life. To all of our listeners, to all of our followers, all of our watchers, thank you for joining us on another episode of the Content Cocktail Hour. Until next time, cheers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining the Content Cocktail Hour powered by The Juice. If you want to see more episodes or more resources curated for your role, join us on app.thejuicehq.com. See you next time. Same time, same place. Cheers.